You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday, the 7th of March. My name is Jemima, and I'm your panellist for today, and I have Charlie and Sam, who are producing from home, but they've created some fantastic pieces to kick off the week in news for you, so do stay tuned in. E whai aki nei, coming up on the show today, Charlie speaks to Samuel Hickey from the Centre for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation, and he discusses Russia's weapons and nuclear power plants. She also speaks to Dr. Anna Brooks from the University of Auckland about long COVID. And finally, Charlie speaks to Dr. Jennifer Gadd from NIWA and Melanie Carr from the University of Auckland about hazardous chemicals in the environment. Sam has another couple of pieces for you as well. He speaks about the critical workers exemption scheme with the Green Party's Jan Logie, and he is also talking to the National Party's Todd Muller about his sunscreen bill. And so much stuff coming up on the Monday Wire. We have Tomorrow's World, which is an awesome segment that is produced by Isla and Stella. Isla and Stella are longtime news teamers here with us at 95BFM, and they, on Tomorrow's World, they look into how science impacts us as humans here living on Earth. So today, they are looking into what is carbon neutral, and they look at the sustainability of the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics, which I'm sure some of you have been keeping an eye on. And also to plug some sports stuff, because if you haven't heard, there is a really good online podcast that's just been started at BFM with Joe, Anika and Rob, and it's called The Playbook. You can check it out on our website at 95bfm.com, and I do believe they chat Winter Olympics. So if you want to get some more Winter Olympics news in, that's a really, really awesome piece of work to check out as well. He aho whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces on the show today. So do send us through a text on 5395, or you can give me a call in studio on 309 3879. And also, as I said, after the show, you can check out these stories and more, like The Playbook, by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. If you head to the BCast page on our website, you can check out all the awesome content that's produced by all the awesome 95BFM volunteers and people. So there's some really cool stuff. So do check it out. Right, enough of me rambling on. Let's crack into the news.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
2 days ago, Russia attacked a nuclear power plant in Ukraine, coming just after Russia moved in on the Chernobyl exclusion zone. On the 28th of February, the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States confirmed that 70 soldiers were killed with a vacuum bomb. Tension is continuously increasing within the area, with military assistance from Western allies being given to Ukraine and Putin putting Russia's nuclear forces on high alert. Charlie spoke with Samuel Hickey, a research analyst at the Centre for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation, about the weapons being used and attacks on nuclear power plants. Charlie began by asking what the main concern around Russia attacking nuclear facilities in Ukraine is.
2 days ago, Russia attacked the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, coming just after Russia moved in on the Chernobyl exclusion zone. On the 28th of February, the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States confirmed that 70 soldiers were killed with a vacuum bomb. Tension is continuously increasing within the area, with military assistance from Western allies being given to Ukraine and Putin putting Russia's nuclear forces on high alert. I spoke with Samuel Hickey, a research analyst at the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation, about the weapons being used and attacks on nuclear power plants. I began by asking what's the main concern around Russia attacking nuclear facilities in Ukraine.
This is the first war to involve combat around active reactors. And these reactors require a constant supply of electricity and water to keep their cores and their spent fuel pools cool. So no nuclear reactor is designed to operate in a war zone. In fact, this is the first time that a civilian nuclear reactor has ever come under military assault. It is important to note, however, that this is that the situation is under control at the moment. There was a fire at a separate facility. It was very close to the reactors at that site. The building is a training or construction facility adjacent to the reactor, which caused a fire that was eventually extinguished. But actually, the firefighters that were on their way to this reactor even came under assault, and there was gunfire that was going on in their efforts just to put it out. So that was the situation then. And if you'll indulge me, there's actually a human component of this that sometimes gets lost in it. But so two people were injured, and both of them were security personnel. But it was critical, and a lot of experts were highlighting this, that they were not operators or technical people. So nuclear power plants rely on and are operated by people. And these people live in the town or the village near the plant, and many are engulfed in the fighting as we speak. So these people need to travel from their homes to the reactor, which means shuttling through a war zone. So this is where, if there are ever any security issues or safety issues at these facilities, suddenly the war has a whole lot of ways of impacting the security of a plant. So actually, remarkably, even before this fire took place, there was workers from the plant in southern Ukraine and local civilians erected barricades on the access roads in an effort to prevent Russian troops who now control the area around the facility from taking it over. But if we were to start to look at some of the potential ways that this could all play out, because hopefully there will be no more attacks on civilian nuclear reactors in Ukraine, but there are 15 reactors. This was actually the largest nuclear power plant, so it had 6 reactors there. But if we wanted to start thinking about the concerns, essentially, so the fuel inside of a nuclear reactor is very radioactively hot, so it has to be continuously cooled. And this is the key part, is that if a war has a number of different ways that can disrupt the cooling of the reactor, the primary means of getting energy to cool the reactor can be thwarted when the electricity grid is attacked. And that's something that I understand Russia is doing now, but it's a very common tactic in a war. And it's likely that this sort of thing will continue. So that could be a problem. Nuclear power plants often have, or they all have backup generators, but those don't necessarily last for long periods of time. So that's really where we start to see different scenarios that could play out that would be rather dangerous.
Have there been similar attacks on other power plants? And sort of what was the result of those?
So this is the first time that our nuclear reactor has come under military assault. However, attacking just general electricity grids and other power plants, that happens all the time. It happens incredibly often. It's a very useful tactic in a war, because at the end of the day, this war has already become about the civilians, right? We actually really expected that Russia would be able to move through and take Kyiv far faster than it has been. The Ukrainian forces have been exceptional in this, and the Ukrainian civilians as well. So now it seems that Putin has turned a lot of his ire on the civilians, and this is where we're seeing a lot more attacks. But just throughout history, making sure that people don't have access to the things that they need, just the basic necessities, or possibly electricity so that they can communicate with the rest of the world. All of these things are tactics in a war to help suffocate the civilians.
And just moving away from the power plants and more onto what weapons Russia may have, do you have any insight on this?
So the United States and Russia have together over 90% of the nuclear weapons in the world. There are 9 countries with nuclear weapons, but just the United States and Russia have together over 90%. Each have about 6,000 warheads in their stockpile. However, under the terms of the last remaining treaty between these two countries, New START, both are only allowed to deploy about 1,500 nuclear weapons. Now, Putin has actually made explicit threats about use of nuclear weapons in order to keep the United States, NATO, other countries from coming to the aid of Ukraine. Now, Ukraine is not under the United States nuclear umbrella. It does not have nuclear weapons itself, nor is it a NATO ally. So the United States or any other countries are not, you know, they do not have to come to the aid of Ukraine with such military support. So Putin is able to essentially wage a conventional war and using his nuclear weapons as a shield to keep other countries away, because he is threatening, if you do come to Ukraine's aid, if you do make this more difficult, I will escalate to this far, far greater level. So that's really the key part here, where the myth that deterrence was a way for us to keep the peace, that's really not the case.
When reading one of the articles that your center has, it discussed the difference between nuclear weapons and thermobaric weapons. Could you just explain the difference between this?
We put this piece together initially because there were some press reports talking about how they're the biggest conventional weapon, or like, you know, the poor man's not nuclear weapon. They cannot be considered in at the same level at all. They are just not in the same class. So a thermobaric weapons are a subclass of volumetric weapons, a family that includes thermobaric weapons and fuel air explosives. They consist of a fuel container and two separate explosive charges. So when a volumetric weapon is dropped or launched, the first charge detonates to disperse the fuel particles. And then the second charge ignites the dispersed fuel and oxygen in the air, creating a blast wave of extreme pressure and heat that has the potential to reverberate and to create a partial vacuum in an enclosed space. And they're often used to hurt civilians, and they are quite indiscriminate and uncontained. So they are very, very dangerous and quite deadly. However, the largest one ever tested was actually by the Russians in 2007. It had a yield of 44 tons. And just for the comparison, so the smallest nuclear weapon that the United States has, and this one happens to be deployed in Europe, has a yield of 300 tons. So already an order of magnitude, it is 10 times bigger. And that is the smallest. Most nuclear weapons are vastly, vastly bigger. The other key point is that nuclear weapons leave behind radiation. So if a nuclear weapon is detonated, there will be radiation that will, you know, leave the space uninhabitable for years and years. Whereas a thermobaric weapon, that's not the case. So the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States actually confirmed that Russia has used vacuum bombs or thermobaric weapons in Ukraine. And they've done this before. They were used in Syria. They were used in Chechnya. But with the comparison to nuclear weapons, we did want to separate that these two are very different, because if the world starts to believe that Russia is using something that is akin to nuclear weapons, then that suddenly brings, you know, the rest of the world in, and we could easily escalate into a nuclear conflict, which we certainly do not want to happen, and we do not want to happen under false pretenses.
That was Samuel Hickey, a research analyst at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, speaking about Russian weapons in Ukraine.
Thank you so much for that one, Charlie. You're on the Monday Wire on 95BFM. Stay tuned in. We've got some more news for you coming up after this.
Crispness, browbone, prestidigitation. These words and more available now at UBIC, your one-stop shop for textbooks, stationery, and all your general literary needs. Course-specific words like gestalt and rhizomatic, all-time classics like chess and hello. Get your semester one course books and more at UBIC. Big words, big emotions. Pop in store Monday to Friday, 8:30 to 5:30 at number 2 Alfred Street, or online at ubiq.co.nz.
Speed limits are changing to make our communities safer. This is part of our Vision Zero commitment towards zero deaths and serious injuries by 2050. Auckland Transport is asking for your feedback on further speed limit changes proposed for Tāmaki Makaurau. This includes setting safe speed limits in town centres such as Devonport, Takapuna and Glen Innes to ensure that pedestrians and tamariki are safe. Visit at.govt.nz/haveyoursay to provide feedback.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
The Critical Workers Exemption Scheme was announced last month, meaning people working in sectors such as food production, supply chain, transport and news media can still come into work if they are in close contact of COVID-19. However, should workers still be able to stay home if they feel unsafe? I spoke to Green Party MP and spokesperson for workplace relations, Jan Logie. Do you think workers should be able to stay home if they feel unsafe?
Well, I guess if we're talking about feeling unsafe in the workplace, then that's actually about putting the onus back on employers to ensure their safety while being at work. And, you know, that can be anything from putting people in cohorts in terms of rostering, making sure that there's the ability to distance and having the appropriate PEP. And we do need to ensure that, and that is an obligation on employers to keep their staff safe. And if people who are immune compromised, we do believe that there needs to be that protection for them to be able to take extra measures to keep themselves safe and be able to stay at home, even though, you know, while we are all so incredibly grateful to everybody who is going to work to keep our health system running and enable us to access the food that we need to be able to survive through this time.
Quite a specific example, I guess, but for some critical workers, if their children test positive, I guess this is mainly school kids, should they be able to stay home to look after their kids?
If their kids need them, in the Greens' perspective, that always has to be the first priority. You can't leave kids unattended without care at home while being positive. That's just irresponsible. And I suspect, you know, people would have something to say if people were being told to do that. And absolutely our expectation is that people are supported to parent their kids when they're sick.
Do you think it should be assumed, or do you think it should be on a case-by-case basis that for critical workers?
I think that the critical workers coming in, and the provision at the moment is that people come in if they're in that list on terms of critical workers and that they've got a negative RAT test. But other provisions in terms of ability to care for sick kids applies, as does protections for people who are immunocompromised, as do requirements on workplaces to provide safe environments. So those, I guess the first two have been strengthened a bit and need to be protected, and the other, just in terms of safe workplaces, needs particular focus now, but is an existing obligation on employers, obviously.
For some workers who may be in more precarious positions, like on a casual contract, what does this mean for their jobs during this current exemption?
Well, in terms of that, I mean, some of that is complicated, isn't it? It's because we've been hearing from people all the way through the pandemic who are on casual contracts with, you know, say in particularly if they've got a contract with a minimum number of hours, but they usually work much longer hours, that they have only been getting support for the minimum hours, and that to the Greens has been unacceptable and needed intervention to fix that. And in the situation, I haven't been hearing direct stories, but I'm sure our unions have, about how that's playing out in this current phase, because we, you know, and this does speak to me about the need to strengthen our employment framework generally to reduce precarious work and to even up that imbalance of power, because as we've seen it time and time again through the pandemic, of how problematic that is in terms of ensuring people's health and safety at work, as well as their basic ability to feed themselves.
Have any unions or workers reached out, or not really? Do you think that'll kind of come about soon?
Yeah, I've reached out to a few just to check in about where things are at the moment, but haven't heard back from them. And it may well be because they're really busy. We certainly have been in conversation earlier in different stages of the pandemic, and the First Union did some great social media for people about what their rights at work were, and then got inundated by calls, particularly from younger people, about, okay, so you're saying these are my rights, how do I access things? Because my employer's saying this. And really, I believe that speaks to our need to have higher rates of unionisation, because it's been really clear that particularly for younger and more marginalised working people, that a conversation with their employer isn't cutting the mustard in terms of being able to access their legal employment rights. You know, of course there are good employers, but in too many cases, they haven't been accessing their basic employment rights, and we need to be able to get that support from unions to more workers to be able to ensure they get those rights.
Do you think a greater union membership in New Zealand would help workers advocate for their rights?
Absolutely. There's super good evidence internationally around one, higher rates of unionisation has reduced economic inequality, but also safer workplaces. You know, you can't question that evidence from overseas experience. So the Greens have promoted default union membership, which is not saying everyone has to be a member, but that when you sign up to a job, that actually the default is that you're joined up to a union and then you can opt out if you don't want to be a member, as opposed to the situation at the moment where people have to opt in and find their way to a union, because we know that for unions to be able to intervene in these cases, actually they need to have the capacity to do that, and with really low union membership, and particularly we see in hospitality, it makes it really hard for them to intervene. Could I just make one other point?
Oh, absolutely, yes please.
Which is the a concern particularly for our health sector, and the, you know, these issues in terms of keeping our essential health services going and ensuring that people are able to stay home if they've got symptoms, even if their RAT test is still showing negative. It's become really, really clear that we don't have enough staff doing those jobs at the moment to give us that cushion for everybody to be safe and make safe decisions. And it was really gutting to see the DHBs last week go to court to prevent our allied health workers from striking. Because we know that they, you know, like, striking's a massive call to make, particularly from workers who are so worried about their patients that they're working 16-hour days on a regular basis to not let them down, that things have got so desperate that they felt the need to strike, and then for the DHBs to go to court and remove that right. Like, this is something, like, I really hope everybody listening will get in behind the healthcare workers and their call for decent wages and safe working conditions, because, you know, like, basically what they're fighting for is a safe health system.
I don't know how to say this. Betula Goose
star? You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Beetlejuice.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Last week, the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment released a report that showed that there were gaps in the monitorisation of hazardous chemicals in the environment. In the media release regarding the report, it stated that there is a robust regulation system on paper, but many of the chemicals used over the past decade have been overlooked. Only 200 chemicals are routinely tested in New Zealand's environment, however, over 30,000 are approved for use. I spoke with Dr. Jennifer Gadd, aquatic chemist at NIWA, about the issue, and began by asking her to tell me a little more about the report and her stance on it.
Sure. So this report by the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment covers how we regulate chemicals in New Zealand. So it's right from deciding what can be imported and used, through to where they're being used and how much, and finally to monitoring their presence in the environment. And the reason the PCA did this investigation is that we really don't have good systems in New Zealand for regulating chemicals, and that's through any of those stages that I just mentioned. The report includes case studies on four different chemicals to show how these are regulated and how much is known about their use in New Zealand. And what the PCA team found is that they really struggled to get information.
So was there any indication of which chemicals were missing when looking at what's contaminating the environment?
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. There's about 150,000 man-made chemicals worldwide, and 30,000 of those are approved for use in New Zealand. And this report really, it didn't look into which chemicals we should be looking into. That wasn't the focus of the report. The issue is that without a good system for regulating and for tracking chemicals, it's really hard to know what might be out there and what we might be missing. So as researchers, we'd often look to overseas studies to show us what chemicals we might want to investigate, what might be building up in the environment. But without having any sort of tracking system, it's hard to know where to focus your study. So you might be looking, for example, for a pesticide in a river, say, in Southland or something, but it's actually used in Canterbury and never used in Southland. So you're putting your effort into the wrong place. And then we really just don't find out what we're missing.
And over the past few years, have you been able to sort of track any increase in environmental damage due to potential hazardous chemicals?
Yeah, that's a hard one to answer because we use chemicals all of the time in so many different parts of our lives, in your shampoo, your body wash, you're using them in the garden, in horticulture and agriculture. So you're out there in so many different places and always in a mixture. So it's very difficult to determine if a particular chemical might be causing harm. And there's also all the other stresses that are out there in the environment. So you've got climate change, you've got increased temperature, you've got changes in this, for example, in stream, changes in stream flow, nutrients. There's so many different issues going on. But there are some examples where particular chemicals can be implicated in causing harm. So, for example, the neonicotinoid class of insecticides, they're implicated in the decline of bees. And those chemicals, or that class, are one of the case studies in this report. And what that shows is that while we do know how much of those chemicals are used in New Zealand, we don't know really where they're used, and we don't have good information at all on where they're ending up, so whether that's in a stream or groundwater or soil. So it makes it really hard to figure out whether we are seeing that increase in chemical or in environmental damage and relating that to particular compounds.
So how does the current regulation system work?
So currently, the New Zealand EPA, the Environmental Protection Authority, regulates chemicals coming into New Zealand. So they will approve chemicals for use, and they suggest particular controls, or recommend require particular controls, whether that's related to the amount that you use or the control the person will use when you're using those chemicals. So there's a whole bunch that go through that pathway. And they do assess the risk to the environment when used. But there's other chemicals that we use in New Zealand that go through different pathways. For example, human medicines go through MedSafe. There's no requirement in that system to assess what might happen to that chemical or that medicine once it's in the environment. But things like antibiotics, steroids, and even things like the contraceptive pill, when we take them, they pass through our body in one form or another, and they are released into the environment through our wastewater treatment plants. So we're missing that step in our regulation.
And so what's your suggestion on improving the regulations?
So this report sets out a whole bunch of recommendations on how to improve our regulation, including making it more comprehensive. A key aspect that we need in New Zealand is tracking. So figuring out not just when you're approving chemical, where it is actually used. And a system that provides some public accessibility to that tracking system, I think, is also really important. In most countries overseas, you can look up a chemical and you can find out in your neighbourhood how much is being used and how much is being released. And I think it's really important for the public to know. And it helps you also apply pressure to those organisation if you want to examine that and get them to reduce their chemical usage. And we're really missing that step in New Zealand at the moment.
So is the current monetarisation, is that all private information?
The regional councils and local councils do monitor some chemicals in the environment, but bearing in mind just that there's about 7,000 approved for use, they generally monitor a much smaller number. Most frequently in the sort of tens of chemicals, but up to maybe 200. This is the 1% of all the chemicals that are out there. So a lot of that information is publicly available. But there's also monitoring that's undertaken like for a resource consent. So if you've got a wastewater discharge from either maybe a human, you know, municipal wastewater treatment plant or a dairy factory or some industrial place, the monitoring that they do for the consent is provided to the council. Theoretically, that is publicly available, but in reality, there's no like website where you can click onto and find that information. Most of that information is just sitting in somebody's email or it's in an Excel file. It's on a council database, but it's not available to the public.
That was Dr. Jennifer Gadd, aquatic chemist at NIWA, speaking about the report and regulation systems for chemicals. I also spoke with Melanie Carr, associate professor at the University of Auckland, about the issue. I began by asking, what are the current most prevalent hazardous chemicals in the environment?
So that's difficult to say. Generally, we prefer to talk about risks rather than just hazard or toxicity alone. And this is because if you have a chemical that is very toxic, but no one is using it, no one is exposed to it, that's probably not such a big issue. Now, if you take a chemical that is not very toxic, but that is used a lot and ends up everywhere in our environment at relatively high concentration, in that case, you're pretty sure to see some negative impacts at some point. So I'd rather focus on the risks concept and to identify the most risky chemicals, we basically need three elements. The first one is how toxic they are, but we also need to know how much is used and how much ends up in our environment. And this is really the basic of ecological risk assessment. And it's also the principle that is applied in the report by the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, which is very good.
And so where do most of these hazardous chemicals come from? Are they predominantly industrial, commercial use?
Again, this is something that is very, very difficult to say at the moment. And that's one of the big issues that is identified in this report. New Zealand is the only developed country that has not yet established a national platform for collecting data on known discharges to the environment. So in other words, it means that no one is keeping information on the quantities of chemicals that are imported to New Zealand and what happens to them. So, for instance, a lot of my work looks at the fate of pesticides in the environment, pesticides that are used in agriculture. And for a couple of years, I've been trying to find out how much pesticides are imported, how much pesticides are used in New Zealand every year. And this is very difficult to find. It seems that the most recent report was conducted, or the survey was conducted more than 15 years ago. And this is obviously really outdated now.
These sort of monitoring systems, there isn't really a clear one, but has it sort of improved over the years, or has it stayed the same from what you've said?
So there is some monitoring going on. There's been really great improvements over the last decades when we look at nutrients or bacterial contamination. Also, a few metals such as zinc or copper are routinely monitored. But if we look at organic contaminants such as pesticides or pharmaceuticals, then we really have little data. The report by the PC suggests that there are fewer than 200 chemicals that are regularly monitored across New Zealand. But if we think that we have more than 30,000 chemicals registered in New Zealand, that means that we are monitoring only one compound for 150 compounds that are potentially used. So we are very likely to miss anything that may be in our environment. And that's a general issue with contaminants. If you don't look specifically for it, we may never know that it's there until it is too late.
Do you think it's feasible to try and look for 30,000 chemicals, or should we just be increasing slightly to the ones that might cause the main concerns?
So it is definitely not possible to track in details 30,000 chemicals. And this is where the prioritization exercise is very important. We have to identify those compounds that are the most used, are the most toxic, that are likely to end up in our environment, so that we can focus our attention and our resources on those few. More than one out of 150 would be fantastic, obviously.
Were there any indications of what those chemicals might be?
So To be honest with you, I don't want to suggest any chemicals at this stage. A lot of my work is around pesticides, and so I would definitely like more monitoring for pesticides, because somehow they tick the three boxes. They are toxic, they are used a lot, and we know that, you know, they are applied in the open environment. So they are in our environment. But it doesn't mean that those pesticides are the most risky. You can think about antibiotics or some pharmaceuticals or other industrial chemicals that we may not be fully aware of now that could be also a high priority for further monitoring.
In the report, there were some solutions given. Can you discuss those a bit more?
Yeah, sure. So one of the key recommendations is really to start collecting information on the quantity and use of chemicals in New Zealand. And from this, we can think that this information is really useful to design some monitoring to match the use pattern. So that's, I think, a very, very good starting point. And another recommendation to follow this is to develop guidance for best practices for monitoring. So it means that the different organizations that are currently conducting some monitoring, they would apply the same protocol. They would monitor our environment, soil, sediments, groundwater, surface water in the same way. So then we can then integrate the data and get a bigger picture at the national level. This is definitely not possible at the moment. These are two important solutions, recommendations made by the PC that I think are really useful.
And what do you think are the next steps to getting closer to those solutions?
Resources. Monitoring is really expensive. Keeping data, integrating it, require people to really have a look at those numbers, require industry to make declaration and so on. So I'm really hoping that this report will help unlocking some of the resources that are needed to tackle the challenges that we are facing. More resources for researchers as well would be fantastic, so that we can better understand what happens to contaminants in our unique environment.
That was Melanie Carr, Associate Professor at the University of Auckland, discussing hazardous chemicals and improvements New Zealand could make to monitoring them.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Last week, the Sunscreen Product Safety Bill was passed, which requires manufacturers to meet SPF ratings or face fines up to $600,000. This bill is from Bave Plenty MP and former National Leader Todd Muller. I spoke to him this morning about the bill, as well as further measures we could take in New Zealand for sun protection. How do you think sunscreen manufacturers will respond to the regulations?
Obviously when we were putting this bill through, or I was putting this bill through the select committee, a few of them turned up and gave their feedback on the bill. And most of them tended to be supportive because they held the view that their product met the standard, and this would be challenging for, in their view, the small numbers that don't. So if you take that at face value, I think, you know, the manufacturers see this as important because, you know, having consumer trust in their product is pretty important for their brand, frankly. So I think, yeah, by and large, they'll welcome it. But, you know, frankly, they should, because if they say it's SPS 50, then it should be.
And do you think there is still some work to be done to prevent skin cancer in New Zealand?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's one of those things, that it's sort of a little bit like wearing a seatbelt in a car. You know, when I was a young fella, which, you know, now is a few years ago, you know, we didn't wear seatbelts in the back of the car. You know, the baby seats were, you know, appalling when you look at them. And then over 30, 40 years, education, you know, people sort of realise that actually if you wear a seatbelt and something, you have a, you know, if you crash, you're going to save your life. And so sort of people's behaviour changes, I think a little bit to the same with drink driving, right? And I think some, you know, New Zealanders' reaction and appreciation of the damage that too much sun, or particularly without sunscreen, can cause you. And I sort of see the same thing happening. You know, you probably can answer that better than I can, you know. Are you aware of the importance of putting sunscreen on when you go to the Mount Beach? I suspect the answer is yes. right? When I was a young fella, the answer was no. So yeah, I'm pretty positive that, you know, people will change and continue to change. And that's why I fought hard for this, because you got to make sure that if people are going to reach out for sunscreen, that if it says it's SPF 50, then it's going to do the job.
Mm. And I'm sure you must know, but New Zealanders pay almost double for the same product that's sold in Australia for sunblock. Do you think the price is a barrier for some people?
Well, undoubtedly it will be for some people. What I have noticed, and you know, that criticism, if you like, around the price points between New Zealand and Australia, I think is across quite a lot. We seem to be a high cost, high inflation kind of country at the moment. And so I think it's more than just sunscreen that comparison doesn't work in our favour. On the positive, you know, if you're out on the beach, again, you might have seen this. You know, often there are, you know, people are walking around now with, free sunscreen. You know, if you're out in events, admittedly that's a cost anyway to go to the cricket or something like that. You know, I noticed when I watched the cricket this last summer, that people walking around with, free sunblock for people. So, you know, I think that sort of goes some way. But you're right, it should be, certainly is less expensive than it currently is.
Do you think GST should be removed, for example?
No, I don't. I think that ends up being a false argument, right? Because you then start saying, well, GST should come off fruit and then maybe off vegetables and then maybe off, period products and then maybe sunscreen. And suddenly you got the list as long as your arm, and it becomes a very, very difficult scheme to administer. You know, the fact is that, you know, now for 30 years we've had GST in this country, and it's on everything, and because it's on everything makes it a very, very efficient tax to manage. I think the greater issue is, why is it that New Zealand sunscreens are that more expensive? Why is so much more things in New Zealand expensive relative to Australia? But, you know, that'll take us down to a, you know, acutely political conversation, which I suspect you don't want.
No. I mean, what do you think the government could do to make some of those products more affordable or, I guess, more competitive with the Australian market?
Yeah, well, part of, you know, the Commerce Commission role is to ensure that there isn't any, price gouging, that there's suitable competition, because, you know, if there is competition, then normally, you know, the price settles to what the market's willing to pay. But that said, because we are a small market and often, you know, we can have different brands out in the, you know, across a whole lot of consumer products. But if you look behind those brands, there are perhaps less competition between the parent companies, if you know what I mean. And so, you know, you just got to be wary of that. But, you know, I'm from the National Party, which means that, you know, we support the market actually working, as opposed to the government always being the first point of call to fix things, right? You know, and these guys have a view that, you know, if there's a problem, then it's the government's job to come in and fix it with more regulation. My view is that ends up being very inefficient and costing more in the long run. You know, we've got to look at the fact we're 5 million people. You know, that's a small city in the global context. We do have, a wide array of sunscreens on the market. They are quite expensive, but it appears that the competition is working. My issue is that above all else, those products need to be true to their label and true to what they say they are. Because, you know, if you're going to spend some money for a decent SPF 50 sunscreen, then you expect it to be SPF 50, not SPF 30. And that's been what I've been absolutely focused on over the last 6 months, and bloody awesome to get everyone's support and pass something in Parliament from the opposition, which doesn't often happen.
That was Bay of Plenty MP and former National leader Todd Muller on his recently passed sunscreen product safety bill. You're on the Monday Wire on 95BFM. Charlie and Sam are producing the show. We have one last piece from our other producers, Isla and Stella, and they're going to bring you Tomorrow's World.
The endless parade of time. Who can say what fruits the future will see ripen? We can only keep looking towards
Tomorrow's World with Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins on 95BFM.
For the first episode of 2022, Stella and Isla interview Dr. Georgia Piggott and she is a researcher from the University of Auckland School of Environment about what net zero emissions actually mean. They explore this through the example of Beijing's 2022 Winter Olympics, with additional comments from Professor Justin Hodgkiss, the co-director of the MacDiarmid Institute for Advanced Materials and Nanotechnology, and a lecturer at the Victoria University of Wellington.
Hi, Earthlings.
Is it too late into the game to say Happy New Year?
Well, it feels great to be back at BFM, albeit virtually, as we are both bunkered down with COVID. But we're back and we're making more episodes of Tomorrow's World,
the segment where we discuss science and society and how we all play a role in the future of the Earth, or at least our experience on it.
I'm Isla.
And I'm Stella.
Last year, we discussed topics such as Elon Musk's Neuralink brain chip, alternative meats, the future of our oceans, and looked at the credibility of some viral science TikToks.
This week, we've been inspired by the Winter Olympics.
I'll preface by saying that we have not become athletes in isolation.
Today, we're here to question the credibility of the Games' carbon neutrality.
In fact, running the Games consumed an estimated 2.8 million cubic meters of water. Now, that's enough to fill 1,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
The Games Committee reported that the production of artificial snow would produce no more than 3,000 tonnes of CO2.
But is no more actually really necessary? Or how can we actually validate the 600,000 clean development mechanism credits purchased by the Beijing Olympic Committee?
To provide more insight on the topic, we invited Dr. Georgia Piggott onto the show.
Georgia is an environmental social scientist with more than 15 years of experience in research, teaching, and public policy development on climate change and sustainability.
We started by asking her to introduce her field of research.
I'm a lecturer in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland, and I work on climate mitigation policy primarily. I'm particularly interested in how we address fossil fuels in our climate system and energy transitions. I think we have this massive transition to make in response to climate change, and that's both a challenging and interesting thing to look into as a researcher.
With the Games, what stood out for Stella and I was the fact that the Winter Games were being hosted in China, somewhere that perhaps, especially at the time of year, doesn't have, you know, all the snow and things like that. So a lot of energy was being put into the Games. But I think most importantly, for people who maybe don't understand this claim of carbon neutrality, what is, you know, the claims or the carbon financing?
Right now we have companies all around the world, countries as well, claiming that they're going net zero. These Olympics are just one small microcosm of what's happening all over the place. We have oil companies claiming they're net zero. We have Olympics claiming they're net zero. And so I think it's really important to understand what that means. So I think the thing to understand about net zero is there's two pieces of it, right? There's the net and the zero. So zero, I think, is probably pretty intuitive to most people. We need to cut our emissions down. We need to be doing things that emit less so that we are producing less greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But that's really challenging to do completely. So this is where the net piece of the puzzle comes in. So when companies or countries or anyone who's interested in reducing their emissions can't quite get it down to zero, they look for ways to reduce emissions elsewhere in order to claim that their activities are in some net zero. And typically what that looks like is perhaps going and planting trees that are going to suck out the equivalent of carbon emissions to what that company or what the Olympics is producing. So that, you know, on the balance books, it's zero, but they don't have to necessarily themselves get it down to zero. But trees tend to be a big one and often feature in a lot of plans. And I know in the case of the Olympics were how they did offset their emissions. So essentially, Yes, there are a few different issues. Number one is a tree takes longer to suck those emissions than avoiding those emissions in the first place, because by not putting them up in the atmosphere today, you've got all of that time that it takes for the tree to grow to suck it back down. And speed matters in climate change, because we are now getting to a point that we need to act quickly. And so, you know, avoiding those emissions should be the number one goal, not planting the tree. You know, they did a lot of good things as well. It's just the case that we need to think pretty critically about, you know, are there better ways of avoiding emissions in the Olympics or in anything else we do in society so that we're not relying on these offsets. For those who don't know, the Olympics Committee has also committed to reducing emissions for all Olympics going forward. So they're all going to be carbon neutral from 2030 onwards. And so, you know, we did see a lot of investment in new technologies and interesting things that were part of a genuine effort to reduce emissions. The problem is it's very hard to hold Olympics somewhere that you don't get a lot of snow without using a lot of energy. It's also hard to hold Olympics places that don't have a lot of pre-existing facilities because you have to build them. That uses a lot of emissions. And so it's hard to say that the Olympics themselves were green Olympics just because they did this offsetting. I think that, you know, questions could be raised if we wanted to kind of reflect critically on it about, are there decisions that could have been made earlier in the decision-making process about who hosted the Olympics and where the Olympics were hosted that could have saved us a lot of emissions? Was it perhaps not the right location if climate was in the forefront of your mind when you're making the decision about Olympics? Were there maybe places that could have hosted a little bit more easily? If we put, you know, using existing facilities and reducing emissions that way as a key factor in decision making, we would both save money, have more economically efficient Olympics, as well as energy efficient Olympics. So I think that you can think about, where are we making these decisions? When are we making these decisions? Can we kind of avoid making more damaging decisions early on so that we don't end up in this position of needing to offset as much?
For me, what stood out was the celebration of Beijing being the first ever place to host both the summer and the winter games. And you have expertise in the area of the social aspect of climate change. Why do you think that this was celebrated? And was the excessive production of artificial snow, was it actually worth it in the context of making a carbon neutral games?
It's celebrated for the same reason everybody celebrates getting the Olympics, right? Everybody sees it as a source of national pride. I do think there's kind of this question about, are we going to put some physical limits on where we host Olympics in the future? Can we heat up cold places and run a summer Olympics there, you know, in the middle of winter? Do these things need to factor in at all? So it's an interesting question. I don't think that these climate factors were a major feature because, as I understand, not many people really wanted these Olympics. We're running into this problem, like I said, of Olympics becoming this like very expensive thing, and unless you wanted to do it for like national pride or other reasons, becoming a harder sell for a lot of places to take on the task of the Olympics.
So in terms of people who are listening, or myself, Stella and I, what could we do to support these movements or to make a smaller change from our own perspective who aren't sitting on the board of the games?
That's a really interesting question. The next step is, okay, well, we want you to take it a little bit further and really prioritize low emissions games, not just kind of offsetting the emissions afterwards. Maybe the thing to do is for people to kind of, around the time that that decision is being made, band together with other people to come up with some sort of campaign to pressure the organization to pick the lower emissions option. But you also have to kind of think about this stuff in context. So symbolically, the Olympics are really, really important, right? It matters what happens on this global stage and what it symbolizes in terms of climate change. They have such a long and storied history, right? And so I couldn't come here and talk about how, like, maybe we just get rid of the Olympics altogether. That would reduce emissions. It's such a, you know, important part of what makes us human. So we have to think about these trade-offs. You know, how do we hold an event that naturally has a lot of emissions, but also how do we make sure we do that in a responsible way?
Perhaps something that people could do is look to see if they are audited or if they're somehow certified. How would people do that?
It depends on who they bought their offsets from at the moment as to who's certifying them. But the problem is because we have these different certification bodies, it's not always clear. It's not always clear what net zero means generally. There's not always clear standards about what is and isn't counted as emissions for net zero and where in the supply chain we stop counting. And so there are now groups trying to push for this. And this is kind of an effort that people could get behind, is much clearer standards around what net zero looks like, how we can kind of judge places as net zero or not net zero. It's a difficult thing when you think of all of the countries and companies claiming that they're going net zero. We don't have the space to plant trees for that many organizations to do that at our current rate of emissions. And we definitely don't have the resources to track it all and follow it all up. Have we avoided the emissions to begin with? That should be the forefront question. Net zero can be the thing we do after we've asked that question, but you know, have we done everything to avoid the emissions to begin with? And I think that you guys have hit the nail on the head with the Olympics being a case of, is hosting a Winter Olympics in a warm place the best way to avoid emissions? Yeah. Probably not.
So there we have it. I'm not sure if we can start handing out gold medals for sustainability, but there is a lot more to think about than net zero.
And Georgia has highlighted the importance of trade-offs and how social, technological, economic, and environmental aspects all need to be considered.
Speaking of technology, Tomorrow's World received a statement from Professor Justin Hodgkiss, co-director of the McDermott Institute and an expert in energy and sustainability issues, regarding the need to place net zero claims in a wider context. Professor Hodgkiss says the gross carbon footprint for the Olympics was relatively low due to a combination of innovation and other circumstances. The Olympics used entirely renewable electricity from wind and solar, but this arguably needs to be seen in the context of China's wider dependence on coal. If the renewable electricity was diverted from elsewhere in the grid, then surely more coal will have been used as a result of the Olympics that is not counted. Nevertheless, the Olympics featured other innovations in terms of energy-efficient construction and retrofitting, along with efficient cooling technologies. However, a large part of the real emissions savings resulted from circumstances rather than good planning and technology. No international spectators could travel to attend the Olympics, eliminating a significant chunk of emissions that would otherwise be expected. And after adding up the carbon cost of all of these aspects, the Olympics was made carbon neutral by offsetting, that is, planting enough trees to soak up the equivalent amount of carbon. Planting trees is no doubt a critical part of climate action, but it is dangerous to think that simply offsetting to carbon neutrality will be enough. Trees do not store carbon forever. The goal should really be to make real gross emissions as close to zero as possible so that tree planting can bring the sustained negative net emissions that we need.
Cool, 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 cool. I mean, literally.
That's all we had for you this week, Earthlings.
Stay critical.
Looks like everything's gonna be all right.
Tomorrow's World with Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins on 95BFM.
That was The Wire.
That brings us to the end of the Monday Wire for another week. Massive thank you to you for tuning in and listening to the show today. Big thank you to Sam and Charlie for producing the show, and also to Isla and Stella for producing yet another awesome episode of Tomorrow's World, the first one for 2022. Very exciting. That will be on the Monday Wire fortnightly from now on. Big thank you as well to the people who spoke with us for the show today. I hope you're doing well out there and that you're taking care of yourself. It's just about the end of my time talking on The Wire. You'll hear me tomorrow because I'm panelling again tomorrow, but it's just about the end. It's just about the end. It's weird. Wednesday's my last day. But anyway, hope you're having a good one. Catch you next time. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.